Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After a sexual assault, a victim's body is part of the crime scene. And they have the option to record that scene, to be photographed, plucked, and swabbed for DNA evidence. That evidence, the most intimate kind, goes into what's called a rape kit. It is most often a woman's extra effort to get justice, to get a rapist off the streets. But a big new report finds mountains of that evidence is never even analyzed. Mountains untouched, warehoused, forgotten, a rape victim's effort for nothing, perpetrators going free. This hour on Point, untested rape kits across America and why that happens. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Would you assume that this evidence gathered after a rape would be treated as vital, not stacked and forgotten? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Steve Riley. He is an investigative reporter at USA Today. He's been writing about untested rape kits. He led an investigation by USA Today that found more than 80 and more than 80 partner newspapers and TV stations that uncovered more than 70,000 untested sexual assault kits nationwide. Steve Riley, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York is Kate Snow. Kate's national correspondent for NBC News. She's been traveling around the country reporting on untested rape kits for NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt in partnership with USA Today. Kate Snow, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much, Tom. Good to be here.
Kate, you tell the story of a woman goes by the name Johnny in Detroit. We've got a little sound from her. 1998, she was raped. It took police 13 years to test her rape kit. When they did, they found a DNA match. Her attacker is now in prison. From your report here, Kate, here's Johnny.
It's kind of like a slap in the face to the victim. You know, it makes them maybe not want to report.
You think it might make people think, why bother?
Right. Why waste my time?
Why waste my time? Good, because she might want justice and because it might help somebody else. Here she is saying, you know, if he attacked her, he might attack someone else.
If he felt that comfortable coming through my window, I probably wasn't the first one, and I definitely wouldn't be the last.
Kate Snow, Steve Riley, I'm reading here of thousands and thousands of untested rape kits found more or less forgotten, Kate, in a warehouse in Detroit. How does that happen?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. How does that happen in Detroit? And I think you have to look at the cities individually. Steve did an amazing job canvassing the whole country and looking at the national picture. But it does vary from city to city as to why this is happening. In Detroit, we first reported on that a couple of years ago for Rock Center at NBC News. So I went to that warehouse, and I stood outside of it. They wouldn't let us in, but we stood outside. It is a dingy, you know, old, broken windows, pigeons flying in and out. That's the scene of this warehouse. It was an extra area that they would use for storing evidence in police cases. And frankly, what the police basically told us is these kits had been put on shelves with some good intentions that one day they would get to them. And part of it may have been at the time they didn't have the same technology that we have now. But it was basically neglect. I mean, when it comes down to it, the prosecutor in Detroit, the Wayne County prosecutor, Kim Worthy, who is a force of nature, this woman, she discovered, her office discovered these kits, 11,000 kits, just in this one warehouse, row after row. And they're actually doing something about it now, Tom.
Steve Riley, you did a lot of reporting on this. We've got 18,000 police departments in this country, more or less. You and your partners looked at 1,000, just 1,000 out of 18,000, and in those found 70,000 untested rape kits. Now, I'm looking at numbers here about the 11,000 in Detroit, 9,000 in Memphis, 4,000 in Vegas, 6,000 in Houston. Give us a sense of the national picture and what you found, Steve.
Right. So we've known about some of the large cities for years. It's been discussed for years. What we didn't know is the breadth and scope of this problem across the country. So we looked at records that states maintain and records across the span of different types of agencies across the country. And as Kate said earlier, you have to look at cities individually. We found some jurisdictions test every single kit that comes into evidence. Some test as few as 2 in 10 that they book into evidence. So we have there's a widespread disparity in how this evidence, and it's the same crime in every jurisdiction, but how it's treated by authorities.
Is this evidence not important? I mean, after all, rapes have happened here or are certainly alleged. Women go to no considerable trouble and, I guess, discomfort to say the least, to go through this exam and this collection. Isn't this important evidence, Steve, or not?
That's exactly some of the questions that survivor advocacy groups are asking, you know, the trouble that the individuals go through to have these kits collected raises questions about how it's being handled and why it's not being processed in some cases. Many law enforcement agencies, you know, there's record-keeping issues. They don't even know how many untested sexual assault kits they had. They were unable to tell us when we requested those numbers. And for those that did, only a few kept track of the specific reason why they had not tested those kits. And there are a broad range of explanations, excuses why these kits aren't tested. We found some bureaucratic issues and some explanations as to why they weren't being tested.
We're going to dig into the whys and wherefores here. But on the face of it, Kate, it seems just galling. I mean, after all, a woman is alleging rape here. And then remind us of the sort of standard sequence of events and the process by which she makes this evidence available. This isn't fun.
No, none of this is pretty. I mean, these are all, and again, you say these are allegations of sexual crimes. And so usually a woman, sometimes a man, has something horrible happen to them. Johnny's case, I can't even tell you the full details on the radio because it's too gruesome. But a man broke into her house, held her at gunpoint. She was pregnant at the time. Mm. She had a baby, an infant, next to her. And she alleges the man has since pled to charges and is serving in prison. So I can say he was a rapist and he raped her. And she went to the hospital and she, for hours, she told me, probably 5 hours she spent in the hospital being combed over to gather any evidence they could find because he was a stranger. She didn't know him. Mm-hmm. He had commanded her not to look at him while he held a gun to her head. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was all she had to go after this guy.
So she's not in the shower. She's not cleaning up. She's not at home with friends
actually,
and relatives. She's,
right. She wanted to be comforted by her friends and her family, but she couldn't be. She had to go to the hospital because she wanted justice. And she said to me, I couldn't wait to take a shower. So that is part of the issue here is the extent of the effort that's put into to giving over this very sensitive DNA evidence. But I think, as Steve said, there are a lot of reasons why it's happening. And some are understandable. Some are the system is overwhelmed. There aren't enough labs in some cities. There aren't enough resources. It costs money to test every one of these kits. But some of the reasons that I've heard, especially in Detroit, are not so pretty. They're things like, well, we weren't sure we believed her story. You know, police would write in the margins of some of these evidence, the cases that had the rape kits associated with them. They would write notes. And Kim Worthy, the prosecutor, told me that sometimes the notes would say pretty awful things about the victim themselves. So, the note would say, this person's a prostitute. We're not pursuing this. Now, these are years ago. This is, you know, those kits dated back 20 years. Mm. So I think attitudes have changed toward sexual violence in this country. But that's part of the problem, too, is that in some cases, people just weren't taken seriously.
Women pay a price to have this evidence collected. USA Today talked with Debbie Smith. This was in Williamsburg, Virginia. She was raped by a stranger in 1989. Told USA Today she went through with getting a rape kit exam after her rape, even though it was a terrible experience.
It is a horrible exam. I mean, if you can imagine having to go through somebody plucking pubic hairs and swabbing you, and you're laying there with your legs wide open just after having been attacked in that way. It's humiliating. Even at its very best, this exam is humiliating.
Like a second trauma, Debbie Smith told USA Today, but she did it because of the hope that there will be consequences.
It destroys what you even have left of your self-esteem, but you do it because you know that it will give you hope.
Steve Riley, we're going to dig in here, but is your bottom line that women who have gone through the trauma of rape and then the collection of this evidence are being betrayed?
In many cases, survivors would feel that way, and they go through the experience of having this kit collected, not only to solve their own cases, but to identify perpetrators that could be suspects in other cases.
If these are serial rapists, that DNA evidence could be very important, could be the key to tracking them down to putting them behind bars.
Precisely. So we're talking about these big numbers and these statistics, but at the individual level, you heard from Debbie Smith, her powerful story. It's easy to understand why a sexual assault survivor would feel almost victimized a second time by the failure to test a sexual assault kit.
On the other hand, Kate, maybe the police know their business here, and maybe their jaundiced views of individual cases aside, maybe there are economic reasons not to do this that are well-founded. It costs $500, $1,500, $1,000 to test the rape kit. Did you come away, Kate, thinking, well, some of these, maybe it's okay if they've never been touched?
It's a tough question. I think in some cases that is the case. I know you're going to talk with Phoenix on the show today, and you'll hear their logic. And they have a very they have a policy, they have a procedure, and they know that they're not testing certain kits, and it is purposeful. They make an intentional decision not to test certain kits. And so I personally come away thinking that makes sense to me if you have a policy. What doesn't make sense to me is when there's no policy and it's sort of haphazard and kit by kit, case by case, a decision's being made by someone.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what happens after a rape and why so much evidence from so many women goes unexamined. A new report from 1,000 police departments across the country found 70,000 untested rape kits, intimate evidence collected in a moment of trauma and never used. Steve Riley from USA Today led that investigation. He's with us today from Washington. Kate Snow has followed up with NBC News from around the country, talking with women in police departments. She joins us from New York. Ashley from Southington, Connecticut is calling. Ashley, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What's your question, Ashley?
I actually have a little bit of experience, not personally with rape, but a lot of my friends have gone through it, and I've seen a lot of information online, not necessarily information, but more people treating it like it's not a big deal. And even in some classes that I was in, the concept of rape would come up and there would be like a kind of laughter around it. And honestly, I have been wondering about this since I heard about the untested rape kits. As people who are closer to the situation, I have heard pretty much a deafening silence from the people who were making fun of, like, oh, maybe you didn't really get raped, now that this has come out, that there is this attitude that, you know, a lot of people just don't care about the rape kit. Have you seen sort of contribute to the kind of carelessness that rape is treated with, or has it opened some eyes?
We'll pick it up. Steve Riley, carelessness in regard to rape, attitudes, what, getting better, more focused and more tough on it, or more lax and, as Ashley says, careless about it?
I think you have seen over the past decade or so increasing attention to the issue of sexual assault evidence kits. One thing, though, that we might want to mention, the Detroit backlog, probably the most, you know, notable backlog that's part of the discussion. There was a study by Michigan State University. They found a victim blaming by police was part of the reason there were so many sexual assault kits that hadn't been tested, as Kate talked about earlier. So in some cases, there are specific policies a law enforcement agency would have, and they'll be able to explain why they haven't tested certain kits. In others, there's seem to be possible issues, as the caller mentioned, that have been evolving over the past couple of years.
We'll go to Phoenix and ask about that, to Michigan, where they've done some really strong research on this front. Kate, what about your sense of this? Ashley raises a kind of cultural discounting of the seriousness of rape. What do you make of that?
Well, I do think it's changing. I think, you know, if you look at what they've done in Detroit since discovering all those kits, they've now tested, they've raised money, federal money, state money, and private money. They actually have a website you can go to and donate toward the effort of testing their kits. They've actually cleared that backlog now. 10,000 of the 11,000 kits have been tested. And so they are taking it very seriously.
Were the convictions out of all that?
456 serial rapists, suspected serial rapists, were identified. 456 people.
That seems enormous.
Serial rapists.
I mean, and that was not possible without this. Case closed. Test the kits.
That's right. Yeah, these kits can be invaluable evidence. And I think there's an understanding of that now. And there is a federal movement. There is grant money available through the Department of Justice to help local law enforcement. Well, two things: to help them take inventory of what they have, because as Steve mentioned, 34 states haven't even counted how many kits they have. And two, to actually do the testing. Now, is there enough federal money? Not from the people that I've talked to. I think there's not enough money to go around to do the work that needs to be done. And there may not be enough lab space in individual communities and towns and cities to do the work of testing every single kit that's ever been gathered.
There are other questions around how the DOJ has handled this, and we'll come to that. I want to go to Michigan and Rebecca Campbell in East Lansing, Michigan, professor of community psychology at Michigan State University. She has been right in the thick of looking at what happened in Detroit. Rebecca Campbell, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led to this enormous sort of sloughing off of rape kits in Detroit? I mean, Kate tells us that once they were brought out and most of them analyzed, 456 serial rapists found out. That seems like plenty of justification. How could they have gone untested for so long? What's at work here, Rebecca?
There's a lot of different factors at work here. As Steve and Kate have already noted, there's issues of bureaucracy, record keeping, overwhelmed staff, insufficient personnel. But two key issues really came out in our research project in Detroit. One was that they had no formal policy on rape kit testing, and so it was left to the individual discretion of the investigating officer. So then when we look at the decision-making by those individual officers, that's where we start to see the issues that Kate talked about in terms of victim-blaming beliefs and attitudes. So in our research, we read the reports that were associated with the kits that were not tested, and we saw ample evidence of disregard of victims, not believing them, name-calling, discrediting them, but also a really fundamental misunderstanding of how trauma affects people and how it affects their behavior, their emotions, their demeanor, and their memories.
What do you mean by that? They didn't think the victims acted victimized? So why?
Yes, that they had this idea that if you're sexually assaulted, then you must be crying, upset, really visibly distraught. And so if a victim didn't have any tears, they would write it off as saying, this one's a false report, this is unfounded, because she wasn't acting right. But the interesting thing is the research on the neurobiology of trauma paints a much different picture. It really helps us understand that there are many different behavioral profiles or symptoms that victims exhibit after a sexual assault. And if a victim is sitting there very stone-faced and calm and appears to be cool and collected, there are actually neurobiological reasons for that. And what you're seeing is trauma. It is a sign that something has happened. The police fundamentally misunderstood that, didn't know that. And that, in addition to all the victim blaming, we saw case after case after case marked unfounded, false, unable to establish elements of the crime, and then they didn't test the kit.
I don't know if you even looked at this, but given all the headlines lately, I feel like I have to ask, was there a racial factor in which kits got tested and which did not?
In a city like Detroit, the vast majority of the population is African American, so for statistical modeling, it would be very difficult for us to do those kinds of comparisons. But the upshot of it is, this was from Detroit, what we see are thousands of African American women, some men and children, who went through a horrible crime, a horrific exam, went to the effort of making a police report, and the police elected not to have that kit tested.
Rebecca Campbell, Kate, Steve, please stand by. Olivia is calling from Clinton, Illinois. Olivia, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What's your observation, Olivia?
I have a friend who got raped. She lived in Chicago, and she got a kit, and she went through that whole process. And to my understanding, it's never been tested. And I just wanted to thank you so much for covering this story, because I didn't even know. I'm about to cry. I didn't even know until this happened to someone, you know, personally close to me, that nobody's tested.
Olivia, you're breaking up, but we've got it, that your friend went through a rape. She had the rape kit and felt it wasn't tested. You're glad to hear us talking about it. We're glad, well, we're sorry to have to be on it, but we want to pick it up. I mean, Rebecca Campbell, when a woman is raped, she goes to the authorities, do they automatically say, do the rape kit, you know, have the swabbing and so on? Is that just automatic?
It depends, honestly, what city, what jurisdiction. It's national best practice to recommend that a rape survivor have a medical forensic exam and sexual assault evidence collection kit, primarily, first and foremost, for health care. This is a crime against the body, and it's really important that survivors are getting the health care that they need after a sexual assault.
Yep.
And then once that has been established, to really talk with the patient and determine whether she or he wants to have that forensic evidence collection kit, as we've been talking about today, to collect all those swabs and specimens that then ultimately could be analyzed for DNA and hopefully presented in court someday.
When a woman is handing that over to the hospital, who she presumably understands are going to give it to the police, is she entitled to any expectation, firm expectation of what will happen to that? I mean, after all, she's doing something here for a reason, not just to throw it, you know, off a cliff.
I think historically it has been an implicit contract, if you will, that in the expectation that the kits would be tested and something would happen with it. I think now as this issue is coming to light, that's becoming codified in state laws that if you release this kit for testing, it will be picked up in this amount of time. It will be tested in this amount of time, and you will have access to this kind of information in this amount of time. But historically, it has been vague at best.
Let's go directly to a police department where they've got a lot of experience with this and their own way of handling it. I want to go to Phoenix, Arizona, and Sergeant Trent Crump, spokesperson for the Phoenix Police Department. Phoenix has had more than 1,700 untested rape kits, one of the highest numbers in the country for its population. Sergeant Crump, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
There is a response of outrage when people hear the kind of numbers that USA Today has come up with. Help us understand how you look at this from your position at the Phoenix Police Department. You've got a bunch of untested kits. Why?
Sure, and I appreciate the opportunity to do just that. And I think that first we have to point out, I don't think that there's any sort of justification that can be had for a situation like Detroit and some other cities. And so we have tried to model a policy here that we think is a model policy on best practices. And of course, we sit here and have openly talked with USA Today and NBC about
yep.
how we do these cases. But there are, you know, ultimately, there are several reasons in our evidence-based decision-making, if you will, that have to do with how the evidence is collected, seizure, gathering, due process, issues of consensual sex partners. You know, most of the kits, if not all, that we have gone through and back through and re-reviewed in our review process and our protocols are kits that are indicating a no-victim desired prosecution, refusing to cooperate or now unavailable, you know, refusing to identify consensual sex partners, cases that are cleared by arrest and DNA is already in the system. X-cleared or exceptional cleared cases which may result in or come from a suspect that is now deceased or a victim that is deceased. And so, you know, we have some very stringent protocols that we have in place that we think are model protocols, but ultimately at the end of the day, you still have a number of kits, especially when we have a state law in Arizona that says we'll keep all the kits for 55 years, that you're going to have a certain number of those that are going to accumulate over time. And so, you know, we're trying to look at that very responsibly from the standpoint. And people should understand when they see a number in Phoenix of 1,700, there's not one of those kits that has a suspect that is unknown in this particular case. And so there's some of these things that have gone on in other cities that have perpetuated this problem in law enforcement. We agree with that. And so we're looking at how do you establish best practice and best science in order to help prosecute the cases. And that's
Sergeant Krupp, let me come in here, if I may. You laid out a lot of potential reasons not to test there. And Rebecca Campbell, I hope you're listening closely as well. One that struck my ear, Sergeant, was refusal to ID consensual sex partners. Now, if someone's come in, let's say a woman's come in and said, I've been raped, and there hasn't been a trial, so how are you coming to the conclusion that it was consensual?
Well, no, we're just talking about, you're talking about different reasons as to why. And so getting into consensual sex partners with DNA is there in place so that innocent persons aren't entered into the National Crime Database.
How do you know it's consensual if the woman's come in and said, I'm a rape victim?
Yeah, and so I'm talking in a hypothetical sense of, you know, you're asking some of the reasons mm-hmm. that are listed or what why we look at kits that may not be entered. And so you'd have to give me a specific scenario for me to be able to answer a specific question okay. for you. But it ultimately comes down to the fact of, for this, is what is best evidence? Is the DNA already in the database? We are an arrestee state in Arizona also, so everyone who is arrested, their DNA is already taken and in the system. And so we look at all of those factors when we're deciding on some of these kits. And so there is still some discretion based on the investigation that the detective conducts in a case. You know, if we decide that a case is non-plausible or the story is false or the issue of consent is through a suspect interview that it is consensual, those are some of the cases that we have to look at and decide, okay, have we established the elements of the crime? More importantly, is it eligible for entry into the database? Because there are rules that are set by the FBI that regulate what DNA profiles can be uploaded. It's not just everything. Innocent persons, if you know that a victim has recanted their story, you can't just enter innocent persons into a national crime database.
It's got it. I can hear a lot of room for interpretation in there. Rebecca Campbell, you're listening in Michigan. What do you make of Phoenix and its, Trump puts it, model policy, best practices?
I don't know what evidence their policy is citing as the justification for that policy. It certainly seems inconsistent with the current research on rape kit testing and the results that come for that.
Why?
For example, when we looked in their Detroit cases at non-stranger rapes, so the offender had been identified. Sergeant Krupp made reference to the fact that those would not be tested. Well, in Detroit, those were tested. And what we found was is that they were hitting to other cases. Some of those cases that they hit to in the CODIS, the National DNA Database, were previously unsolved crimes. So they didn't know who the perpetrator was in those other crimes. So as a result of testing a kit where the suspect had been identified by the victim, it gave an incredibly promising investigational lead in another case, a previously unsolved case. That's pretty compelling evidence. In addition, what we also saw in Detroit by testing non-stranger rape kits is that they were able to identify patterns of serial rape. So in one particular case, we can say, well, we don't need to test this because the offender's known, and it's he said, she said anyway. But when you keep testing them, it becomes he said, she said, she said, she said, where they all start matching. The identity of the offender was known in each, but it's when you test them all that you start to see the pattern emerging, that the DNA is coming up in case after case, and it reveals a pattern of serial sexual assault.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what happens after a rape, why so much evidence from so many women goes unexamined. A new report, USA Today and NBC out telling us, looking at 1,000 police departments across the country, they found 70,000 untested rape kits, intimate evidence collected in a moment of trauma, never used. And that's just in 1,000 police departments. We have 18,000 in this country. Steve Riley is here. He led the investigation for USA Today. With us from Washington. From New York, Kate Snow of NBC News. She has followed up right across the country talking with victims, police departments. Rebecca Campbell is here from East Lansing, Michigan and Michigan State. She's done a lot of the research that people are looking at as they consider this problem. And from Phoenix, Arizona, Sergeant Trent Crump to explain their policy on why some kits are not tested. Lots of response online. Ari says testing rape kits is too expensive. Most rapists are serial attackers. Test the kits and get the rapists off the street. Levy Girl says, is there a collection to finance the testing of rape kits? I would contribute. Irony there, there have been millions budgeted to help local departments do this by the federal government, much of that not yet used. Watson said, writes to us, if there were 70,000 men that had to wait, I guess this show would be a conversation on history. They would not stand for it. Carol in Madison, Wisconsin, you're on the air, Carol.
Thank you very much, Tom. I am a rape victim. I was held by one man while I was raped by his friend in a smaller, more rural area of Wisconsin. True story. First of all, I've got to say that going to the ER for collecting the rape evidence was just an absolute trauma after the event. But the purpose of my call was, true story, one of the sheriff's department deputies told a group of men afterwards, in front of me, like a couple weeks after it happened, in yep. front of me, he told a group of men, watch out for Carol. She's trouble.
What did he mean by that, Carol? What did he mean? Was he teasing? Weird word here, but...
Yes. Yes, he thought it was a funny little joke, and of course, I was just astounded. The attitude towards victims in this country, or maybe in the world, Tom, it's almost surreal. Blame the victim. Don't believe her. It's not true.
Carol, I appreciate your call. Not a moment for humor there. Not a moment for teasing, if that's even what it was. Sergeant Crump, what about attitudes here? And what about Rebecca Campbell's concern that with your Phoenix policy, you may actually be missing serial rapists who, yes, they happen to be known to one victim, but if you had the rape kit evidence, the DNA evidence, you might find they were active in other rapes that had gone unsolved.
Sure, I think, and there's a couple of things, and there's no doubt about the social issue that has occurred here, and has there been a change socially in the way that it's looked at, and certainly... I think that there has, but I think that, you know, from a police department's position, we're taking a look at it from a practical standpoint. And, you know, we're looking at suspects out here, and I know that a lot of this is victim-centered, but also as a police department, you know, we're not a victim advocate. We are a fact finder. We are an agency that is out there to try to find the best evidence.
But isn't rape kit testing a matter of fact finding? Isn't a DNA analysis a matter of fact finding?
Oh, absolutely it is. But it's not always the best science in a case like that. You know, there are all kinds of scenarios where you may have what you would consider to be best evidence in a case, and you can directly take the DNA sample from a buccal swab from a suspect and still enter it into the crime database. And so there are certainly methods to what they're saying. You know, our position on it out here is we're an agency that has set some very strict protocols. We are an agency that monitors, we train. We have a family advocacy center, a multidisciplinary approach. We have a wonderful SANE nurse program, highly trained detectives, forensic scientists who are looking at these cases and deciding what is best evidence and what is needed to move forward with prosecution in cases. And so, you know, it's not something that when you're talking about Phoenix, you're talking about forgotten. And so when you do have an agency like ours that has the practices in place You know, where do we go from here? What is acceptable? What is unacceptable? You know, we are not in the position of putting innocent persons into the National Crime Database. We're just not there yet. We're going to continue to...
But my question still says, how do you know they're innocent? How do you know they're innocent?
Well, if you have multiple DNA samples from a kid, or there is an indication of multiple consensual sex partners in some of these, if you have multiple DNA samples, you would then check with your victim about consensual sex partners.
Okay.
A lot of times they'll refuse to identify them, or we can't get a hold of them to find out who those persons are. And so there are CODIS rules, or I should say the National Database rules, for who can be entered in the system. And so if we know and there is factual evidence that a story is non-plausible, we're not going to enter what we believe is an innocent person into a crime database if our investigation has shown otherwise. And we think that's prudent. Might that catch someone else in another case? It might, perhaps, do just that. But you have to look at it and say, you know, we're also in the business of protecting the Constitution and people's constitutional rights. Can everybody on a test all, enter all, be entered into the National Crime Database? And is that what we want?
Rebecca, is that what you want? Test all, enter all?
What our research is telling us is that there's a tremendous amount of information in these kits, and that it is possible to test them and follow the rules of the FBI's clearance for putting things into CODIS, such that cases where there is probable cause, the profile does go into CODIS, and in that, when that happens, as it did in Detroit.
What is CODIS, Rebecca? CODIS?
It's the National DNA Database.
Okay.
So there's appropriately so very strict rules, as Sergeant Crump mentioned, about what can be loaded into that database. So what we're seeing is that if you do test all of the kits, which is what was done in Detroit, and follow all of those rules of CODIS and the FBI as it needs to be done, what we're still seeing come out is a very high number of hits, and again, in non-stranger cases where the victim knew the perpetrator, that those hits are hitting to other cases, previously unsolved cases, other serial sexual offenders. So the idea that this is an either-or, the research doesn't bear that out.
But we can certainly see different interests or priorities at work here. Sergeant Trent Crump in Phoenix at the Phoenix Police Department, I know we've got to let you go. I thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you all.
Michelle in Pamlico, South Carolina. Michelle, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I work directly with victims of sexual assault in another part of the state.
Okay.
And I do want to comment that there has been tremendous positive development with law enforcement. Frontline officers and detectives are doing, I would say, a really improved job of bringing in sexual assault survivors and encouraging them to go through the process with the sexual assault nurse examiners who are forensically trained to collect evidence following the chain of evidence protection in a way that will stand up in court.
But is it worth it, Michelle, or does that stuff just get warehoused in your area?
It depends on the level of interest further up the prosecutorial chain. And so I want to draw a distinction between some comments about the frontline officers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's been a tremendous education effort over the last 25 years. The people that I work with and other sexual assault services programs all across the country have gone out, gone into police departments, put the evidence process in front of law enforcement, explained about trauma in victims, as one of your earlier persons discussed, and there's been a turnaround. We've got many, many sheriffs and chiefs of police departments all over the country who have really worked hard to change the culture of their departments, and they do not tolerate the jokes. They will not tolerate a cavalier attitude towards people who have endured a terrible crime.
Michelle, I'm very glad for your report there from Pamlico in South Carolina. If I may, Steve Riley How does that square with what you have found nationally with your reporting?
I think that does match with a lot of what we looked at and what we found. And we did ask police about this, and one of the case files we looked at in Tennessee, a woman had reported to police twice. She had been raped. A third interview, she said she expressed some doubt, and they ended up never testing the kid as a result. This was about 10 years ago. I asked the department about this case, and they said, you know, we really should have tested that, and we've changed drastically just over the past decade. We've had that response from a lot of agencies that we previously were not handling these cases maybe as we should be and are today. But still, we have these thousands of kits from years ago. That are reflective of past attitudes and processes and practices toward these cases.
Rebecca Campbell, what about our caller's assertion that police are getting better, but if there's a lapse here, it comes further up the prosecutorial chain in deciding whether or not to analyze these rape kits and use them?
I think it's really inconsistent jurisdiction by jurisdiction if we're seeing that kind of change in the local level police. I'm delighted to hear that that's her experience in Wisconsin. It certainly mirrors my experience in some of the cities that I've worked with that have had large numbers of untested kits. I've done training in Detroit, Houston, Salt Lake City. Those are three cities that really stand out to me as organizations where there's been a problem with large numbers of untested kits and a real commitment to getting evidence-based information and training to inform police and to drastically change the way they do things. And we have a model policy now in Michigan that's based on the research on trauma and what best practices are in terms of working with victims. In terms of cases moving up the prosecutorial chain, here's the thing. The prosecutors may not even know that a case exists. In another study I did in six different jurisdictions, we found that on average, 86% of the rapes that were reported to the police were never even referred to the prosecutor for consideration of charges. So the prosecutor can't, you know, move forward on a case if he or she doesn't even know it exists.
Why would that? That's a huge percentage.
It is.
Why?
Because, as we've been talking about and points Steve and Kate have been making, mm-hmm. about a fundamental disbelief of victims, that when a victim doesn't act right or they think it's a he said, she said, or whatever it may be, they don't believe the victim and they don't believe it is worth their investigational time, effort, and resources in the case. So it's marked as unfounded, unable to establish elements of the crime, false report. And it's worth noting that when we were looking at many of these old cases in Detroit, unable to establish elements of the crime was something we saw in a lot of the files. Well, the file that I might be holding in my hand was really thin. It was like two pages.
Yeah.
There had been no investigational effort, no even attempt to identify the suspect or to interview him or to look for canvas the area for witnesses. So the idea that you weren't able to establish the elements of the crime, there was no investigation.
Jean in St. Louis, Missouri. Jean, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. As a victim, it's interesting because my experience was just sort of the police took it seriously. I never went to them. I went to the hospital because I needed medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And after the rape kit, I really didn't want to get involved in any kind of – I was frightened for my life. So it's interesting because I think public opinion sort of, like an earlier caller said, they don't take rape seriously enough. And sometimes I feel like – people need to realize that rapists don't specialize or major. They don't say, oh, no, I only do rape. Maybe they'll care more if their son is held up at gunpoint. I mean, they really don't, in my personal experience, take rape seriously enough, the general public. And I was fortunate, the police, I don't know why, that because I didn't want to participate in that, and I was one of those who was too calm and not crying. And I don't know, but I do think public opinion is sometimes a problem as well.
Gina, I appreciate your call. I should point out it was Michelle, our caller, was saying that was giving kudos to police in South Carolina a little earlier for their attitudes here. Kate Snow, there are going to be plenty of people listening, women in particular, perhaps, and imagining or hate to, but if a person finds themselves in this circumstance and they're going to be wondering, is it worth it? Should I go ahead and go through the extra exam, the extra element of trauma, if you will, to have this evidence taken, the rape kit put together with DNA evidence and all the rest? What do you say to that person?
Right.
Kate, is it worth it? Should people, rape victims or people who believe they've been raped, should they do it?
It's an interesting question, and I would quote Johnny, the woman that we just talked to a couple of weeks ago from Detroit, who we mentioned at the top of the program. She was raped in 1998. It took 13 years for them to finally test her kid and finally find the man who is now in prison for 15 to 17 mm-hmm. years for, I'm sorry, yeah, 11 to 37 years, excuse me, mm-hmm. for doing that. She says, I would just like to say to the other survivors out there that may be sitting where I was sitting once upon a time and waiting for that phone call, keep the faith. Don't give up hope. So her words to us were very clear. Get the rape kit. Have the evidence taken. It's worth it. And, you know, the attitudes are changing. And she said, you know, you may get that phone call one day.
We want to support that faith with a system that follows up. Steve Riley, where does the Department of Justice stand on publishing best practices here that might encourage, in addition to money, police departments to get on board and get this done?
That's right. Congress in 2013 passed the SAFER Act, and a lot of that dealt with funding issues. Part of it dealt with a requirement that the Department of Justice develop and publish a protocol for how to handle these tests, or the kits, rather. So we're seeing across different states and jurisdictions widespread disparities in practices, and I think the intent was to have some national model policy. So far, the deadline for that was September 2014. That deadline came and went, and they now tell us December 2016 they finally plan to publish those protocols.
December 2016. It sounds like a long time. Rebecca, are we on the right road here, headed in the right direction?
Yes, I think we are. I think that we are starting to get dialogue about this, trying to figure out county by county, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, how many kits are there, getting the message out to survivors about the importance of getting health care after a sexual assault, and the training that we're seeing for frontline practitioners to educate them about the science of trauma and how it can be useful to them in investigating and prosecuting these cases.
Rebecca Campbell at Michigan State University, thanks for all of your work on this, Professor Campbell.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Kate Snow with NBC News and Steve Riley with USA Today, thank you so much for digging in deep and for being with us today. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.